This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Northwest Indiana Forum is working with NERPC to host a Brownfield Redevelopment Education Panel discussion here in Northwest Indiana this week. And with us from the forum, we have Kay Nelson, who handles the environmental affairs for the Northwest Indiana Forum. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to see you again.
Well, it's nice to see you again. For folks who are not familiar with brownfields are, please educate us.
Well, the national definition of a brownfield is a site with known or perceived contamination from historical use. So it's a very broad definition and one that oftentimes can cause a little bit of chaos if you're not paying attention to when you're purchasing a piece of property.
And that's very important because, unfortunately, Northwest Indiana is filled with brownfields, I know, and a lot of them have not been remediated, and a lot of them have been. So I guess it does mean that anyone who's interested in buying property that's been sitting fallow for a long time needs to check it out.
Absolutely. And, you know, brownfields don't necessarily have to be inside our major industries. They can be some of those mom-and-pop businesses that were prevalent in the region in our early history.
Since this is such a broad definition of the term brownfields, I guess that's what causes the most confusion, doesn't it?
It can cause the most confusion, absolutely. However, it is one that we take very seriously, and it's a little easier to be proactive at the beginning than reactive after a mistake.
Mm-hmm. This forum that we're talking about, this presentation, we should say, that the Northwest Indiana Forum and NERPC is working on for this week is going to be on Wednesday. It's going to happen at the headquarters of the forum and NERPC, which happen to be in the same building there in Portage.
Yes, it is.
How convenient to have get everybody together. You have to go, but just down the hall, I guess.
Yeah. And when we're late to our own meetings like that, it doesn't bode well when all you had to do is walk down the hallway, that's for sure.
How many people have, as you know of, at this point signed up to be involved in attending the panel discussion?
We have over 35 persons who have expressed interest, and they range from local communities to engineering companies to site selectors and developers from the Chicagoland area, and those persons in Northwest Indiana who focus upon redevelopment.
Now, since you've had a hand in getting this organized, this is something, obviously, that happens on a regular basis, I guess, and maybe not necessarily here in Northwest Indiana, but these kinds of discussions where people are able to take a look at certainly the definition of brownfields, what these properties are like, you have a chance to get together and realize that people need a regular education on this type of problem that comes up, because I suppose a realtor, I guess, among other people, you get this opportunity to learn more about brownfields. They actually work with these properties when they're in that type of business, commercial business in particular. But the average person doesn't know much about this.
That's correct. The average person, we have enough on our plates on a daily basis. But those professionals who are engaged in economic development and redevelopment have experience with these types of properties. Sometimes the experience is not pleasant or mm-hmm. productive, and other times they do it well. And therefore, the panel discussion persons that Kathy Luther and I have lined up are bringing some different focus points to the audience beyond just the traditional what's a brownfield definition and, you know, some of the initial EPA grant funds that are available for assistance in this manner.
Tell us about some of the people who are going to be participating in Wednesday's discussion.
Absolutely. We have a large number of properties that are on the tax sales, and we have had experience where persons have, with good intentions, purchased a property from a tax sale without doing their due diligence, which is a big problem for that new owner. So we have Joel Markland from BCA Consultants, who's going to be speaking to how to protect yourself when going through tax sales. We have an existing EPA brownfield grant that NERPC, the RDA, and the Coalition of Cities have in place that Rob Walker from SME Consultants is going to explain some of the success stories that have been garnered through that process. And traditionally, people have heard the term of insurance recovery. A lot of times, previous insurance policies can be utilized for assisting in the cleanup. But oftentimes, people don't understand the nuances and the stages that are necessary for going through that. So we have a professional from Enviro Forensics, Chris Jaros, who's going to be speaking to that as well. We know that the corner gas stations, the small dry cleaners, pose an environmental problem for communities, and we're really excited to have Cam Starnes from Taft Law, who's been engaged in a lot of projects specific to redevelopment of dry cleaner and gasoline sites. So that should be of interest to a number of our communities. And one of our shining examples of a very progressive brownfield redevelopment is in LaPorte, over in LaPorte County, mm-hmm. called Newport Landing. And Nick Minnick is going to be talking about how the city of LaPorte has taken that large piece of property from the early stages to where they are today, and some of the unique financing that the city of LaPorte has utilized in order to keep that project moving forward as they do cleanups. And then just recently, the EPA has a new BUILD Act, and sadly, I forgot to write out what that acronym stands for, but it is a new EPA grant program, and Beth Grigsby, also from SME, will be explaining that to the audience. The challenge that Kathy and I had when we were putting our laundry list together of persons we wanted to have speak, everyone that we asked agreed to speak. And so we're really going to be time constrained on Wednesday, but we're really looking forward to the audience having the opportunity to interact with these professionals and be able to network with them following the meeting and hopefully seeing some fruition from that.
It sounds like that the speakers won't have a lot of time to be able to spend on their little presentations before the Q&A session begins, it sounds like. But it sounds like that if the questions come up, that there'll be enough people there that everybody will have an answer, or at least should at least get a start on an answer with things.
Absolutely. And with concluding at 11:30, generally speaking, folks will be able to stay and talk with those panel mm-hmm. members, you know, through the lunch hour if necessary. All of the speakers have been very generous with their time, saying that they would make themselves available for as long as questions were to go.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the topic of the fact that brownfields tend to be kind of grouped into different categories. And you mentioned about the fact that you've got the dry cleaners and you have the gas stations, because I know those are probably the two major types of commercial businesses that people would automatically assume it might come under this heading of brownfield because of the types of chemicals that might have been used in a business or the types of material that might have been handled. You see a lot of cleanup that's done in gas stations.
That's
correct. A lot of gas stations get regular, the ones that are still in business, get regular cleanup because they know of the type of materials that they're handling. We're talking about petroleum products in this case.
Correct.
And probably, too, other people don't realize that even just your average building, it may have housed a print shop. Is a type of building that could be considered as a brownfield site.
That is correct. You know, over the course of history, we've all gotten a little bit smarter. Back in the early days, we thought that Mother Earth could take care of anything we threw at her, be mm-hmm. it in the air or the water or onto the land. And as we've gotten smarter, we have replaced the toxic chemicals with less toxic or, you know, biodegradable materials, but that doesn't take away the historical contamination that's out there. So it's a combination of utilizing what we've learned and how we've replaced and how to move it forward.
Do we find that there are more and more communities here in Northwest Indiana that have come into these sites? Maybe the city redevelopment commissions or the officers that work for the departments have come onto these properties. They happen to see in a particular neighborhood there might be some closed-up businesses that might be ripe for reuse in some way or the other. But the problem is they have these problems sites that they have to deal with first.
That's correct. The phase one, phase two of an EPA brownfield grant, they're time constrained. They, mm-hmm. when you perform those and you get the information from that, they're only, quote, good, unquote, for a six-month period of time before needing to be replicated. So therefore, we're trying to work with the communities in order to do what we call land assembly from the local economic development organizations, from the forum, from a regional standpoint with NERPSE, so that the communities are looking at a plot of properties that they can work and pull together so that they can address and move it forward in a timely fashion.
When you have these regular panel discussions like this to talk about what brownfields are for those organizations that aren't up to speed on what brownfields are and the opportunities for getting the funds from the federal government and I suppose even from Indianapolis to help towards this cleanup effort, you have to have these often.
Well, there's always a dialogue going on with regards to brownfield redevelopment because, as you mentioned, there's new funding opportunities like the Build Act that was just passed a few months ago, in addition to the pre-existing grant programs. Communities are getting a little I would like to clear the air. Our communities know what brownfields are. This is not something that they're coming to without background knowledge. But hearing what some of the other communities from around the state and or even in the region like La Porte are doing will hopefully spur some of them on to thinking new ways of approaching a project in their communities.
So once again, this is a very special program that's getting underway Wednesday. It's the Northwest Indiana Forum and NERPC, which stands for the Northwest Indiana Planning Commission, getting together to host this very special Brownfield Education Panel discussion. It's going to come up on Wednesday. And Wednesday morning, actually, starting at about 9 o'clock in the morning.
No, we're going to start our networking at 8 o'clock, and the program will begin immediately at 8:30 and run till 11:30.
Well, sounds like if you have so many people involved in this, not only as speakers, but as attendees, it's going to happen, by the way, there at the Northwestern Indiana and Forum and the NERPC offices on Southport Road in Portage.
Correct.
You want to get there early, not only to have a chance to meet with people and talk about your specific problems, and then find out from all the panel discussion that's going to happen, it's going to happen in the morning. So get there. Are there still opportunities for folks that haven't signed up to do so?
Absolutely. They can email me at knelson@nwiforum.org. But because this is an open meeting, certainly would not turn anyone away who hasn't pre-registered. We're just going to make nice name tags for folks so that we can have better discussions. But so anyone that comes without pre-registering will just have to have a handwritten name tag, and that's not a problem.
I'm just saying they won't be embarrassed. I'm sure it's an opportunity for people to find out more about the problems of brownfield properties that are abundant here in Northwest Indiana, and they come up all the time when you say that tax sales is this is something that the tax sales seem to reveal more often than not.
Well, the tax sale does not address the environmental historical contamination of a site. And that's why the presentation by Joel Markland at the kickoff of the meeting on Wednesday is really going to be a great opportunity for education. We want to make certain that those persons or communities that are pursuing properties in the tax sale do their due diligence and then make certain that they don't become potentially responsible parties and become ineligible for the grants.
Well, it's very, very much of a shock, especially if you find yourself the owner of property that you don't know what to do with, that you'd like to be able to put back into proper reuse and positive and financial means as well too, but you don't have a site that's cleaned up there to be able to hand off to somebody else to be able to reuse.
That's correct. If you don't do your due diligence when acquiring a piece of property that has environmental contamination, you eliminate yourself and your company or your community from potentially acquiring brownfield EPA grant dollars to assist in some of the remediation. And we don't want to see that happen more than it already has.
Kay Nelson, thanks for being with us to talk about this today.
Thank you so much, Chris. Have a great day.
Thank you. Kay Nelson is the Environmental Affairs Director for the Northwestern Indiana Forum, and the Forum, as well as NERPC, are getting together to host the program on Wednesday at the Forum and the NERPC offices on Southport Road in Portage. If you're interested about finding out more about how to redevelop brownfields, all the legal and other means that you have to go through to be able to get that property back in proper use again, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Some big changes coming to the Green Sense Farms in Porter County that you might be aware of. They're going to convert the farm basically to not only a farm, and we'll find out more about that in a moment, but also the fact that it's going to be a full-fledged research and development farm. And to tell us more about it, we have the founding farmer and CEO of Green Sense Farms, Robert Colangelo, with us. Robert, thanks for joining us here in Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with Green Sense Farms over in the Portage area, tell us how the farm got started and the very interesting and rather innovative way that you're learning how to grow plants.
Well, we have a transformative way to grow produce indoors 365 days a year without the use of pesticides or GMOs. And we started our farm in 2012 here in Portage. And since then, we've learned a lot. One of the things we learned is that we're at the beginning of a brand new industry, which requires lots of research and development to keep our technology current and to allow us to grow year-round and always be locally grown.
One of the interesting things that I've learned here about GreenSense Farms is the rather innovative way that you have come up with an indoor vertical growing system. Will you please explain how this really works and how it's become so productive in creating produce that people are going to enjoy year-round now?
The simple answer is we took horizontal farming, which has been done for thousands of years in a field farm outdoor, and we brought it inside and we stacked it. So we grow in hydroponic tubs where we interject the nutrient in the water into a plant's root system. So we give them exactly what they need, the right amount of fertilizer, the right amount of nutrient, the right amount of light, and also we control the environment so that the temperature and humidity and CO2 are perfect for the plants to go through the photosynthesis process. And by doing this, it allows us to grow year-round regardless of weather and outside climate.
I guess it's not a unique concept, but the way that you're doing it certainly is. I know that you've been able to expand GreenSense Farms from just the operation in Portage here in Indiana to near South Bend, and you've got some other locations too. And I imagine it's all part and parcel of being able to find ways to grow plants, even though indoors, in different kinds of climates.
Yes. The trick is to create one environment that's good for the plants, and then be able to build these farms around the world regardless of the outside climate. So we are building a farm in Las Vegas where it's very hot and dry. We're also building a farm in French Polynesia where it's very hot and humid, and also one in South Bend where you get hot summers and very cold winters. So regardless of the outside temperature and climate, we can still grow consistently year-round because we control the indoor climate.
Now, Robert, what do you hope to take in making this conversion of just from the regular farm that you've set up here at the GreenSense Farms in Portage into a full-fledged research and development operation? What's it take to make the transition from one type of farm to basically another?
When we started this farm, we were doing both commercial production as well as doing R&D on systems and on the cultivars or the varieties of plants we can grow. By stopping our commercial production, we can now focus on testing new systems, such as different LED lights, both intensity and frequency. We can also test climate control systems that measure and monitor our temperature and our humidity. We could also test automated sensors and automation control devices, as well as automated packaging and conveyance equipment. On the other side, we're constantly improving our growing process, being able to get a higher density of plant per square foot and more plants per level, and turning our towers more often per month. So working on all those variables is what the center is going to be turned into. It was very difficult to grow for commercial production and sales and do R&D. We weren't doing either very well. Now we can have it very focused on R&D.
Yeah, it sounds like that you really have to devote space and time and effort from one or the other. And you can't, seemingly, as you've discovered, you can't do both at the same time, and you do justice to everything, I suppose. So it's probably well worth the time to convert over and be able to rely on the farms that you've set up, and in turn showing those as examples to the rest of the world that these are the ways that you can help grow plants indoors and vegetable produce indoors and do it economically as well as agronomically. So it works out very well, I would imagine, to do this. And then you can spend your time on research and development here in Portage.
Yes, and we're very lucky. We're working very closely with Purdue, Dr. Kerry Mitchell and Hazel Weinstein, who runs the horticultural college there. They have been tied into a NASA grant to be working on different aspects of growing for the Mars and the lunar grow modules. And also, the indoor vertical farming industry has grown a lot since we were one of the first early adopters of this technology. And last year, over $1.6 billion has been raised to fund indoor vertical farm startups. So Our competitive advantage is being able to always develop the best growing technologies and then work on new cultivars that we can grow indoors at high densities. And so for us to remain competitive, we have to constantly raise technology, raise capital, and improve our technology.
Now, I know that since you worked so hard to be able to get the process started to begin with, you've been able to expand it from Portage into these other farms, including South Bend, and what you have set up that you're getting going on, I guess, in the South Pacific as well as in Las Vegas. You mentioned, too, that I guess you're trying to branch out around the world. There's some many other countries that would, I'm sure, be interested or have looked at this. And I also understand, too, from your staff have told me that you've had an opportunity to take this up to some folks who are very interested in this operation from overseas. In fact, you had a recent visitor to Green Sense Farms there in Portage, I understand, to find out more about this and to talk with them about this.
Yes, our goal is to build a network of indoor vertical farms at our customer's location here in the U.S. and build a produce brand that's nationally known and locally grown through a network of farms that we build, own, and operate here in the USA. And then we license our technology to third parties to run farms that they own abroad. So we've had recent visitors from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Our farms, we can build high-yield farms on a small footprint that use a lot less water, a lot less land, and a lot less fertilizer than greenhouses or field farms. And with the Middle East tight on water, our technology really works well out there.
Well, it certainly sounds that way, that it's a great opportunity to expand this idea into some very workable operations in other countries, too. So it sounds like you've gotten the interest of people overseas. That's the important thing, that it gets to expand from beyond the United States to go around the world, to be sure. And the other thing I was going to ask for sure is, since you've been working on this expansion to the point that you're trying to convert the Green Sense Farms operation in Portage over to this full-time research and development facility, do you have any kind of timetable for this? Is it an ongoing process you're going through now?
We've already started the conversion. And the other thing is that we've noted that most of the R&D facilities are at universities, and they're very small scale.
Right.
So it's very hard to extrapolate the data that's generated from these academic laboratories to production use. So we found that we have a great opportunity to do contract R&D for third parties, both testing systems as well as testing new plants out there. So we've begun that process, and we're very happy with what we're able to do with our current facility.
Well, you know, it sounds like this is a great opportunity to kind of go full circle. You say that you got the assistance from the horticulturists at Purdue University on the West Lafayette campus to get started in this project, and now you're going to be able to do more R&D and be able to help turn some back over to Purdue. I imagine they'll welcome that as well, too.
Yes, Purdue is a great university. They've recently launched the Foundry, which is really geared to entrepreneurs. And I think in the last 18 months, they've launched over 150 startups. So with Mitch Daniels, now president at Purdue University, has done just a great job at trying to commercialize technologies and foster entrepreneurialism. And I really want to give a big shout-out to our staff. We've got a great group of people here that are passionate and dedicated to figuring out how to grow more sustainably. And also, the state of Indiana has really made great strides, being an agricultural state, to try to make Indiana the hub for biopharmaceutical research. And that's really our end goal, is to look at cultivars that we can grow, especially botanical, that can be converted into medicines or vaccines. Because we think growing indoors is very precision growing, and its highest and best use is for vegetables, but making medicines could not be another excellent application.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert, consider the shout-out completed. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I commend you on getting great information through the Lakeshore Public Radio.
Robert Colangelo is the CEO, and he's the founding farmer of Green Sense Farms in Portage, Indiana. And the Portage farm is now making a transition from just being a farm to a state-of-the-art research and development center on its indoor vertical growing systems and testing some new cultivars as well. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Reagan Hatcher and Jessica Renslow are seeking the Democratic Party nomination for the seat held by Representative Charlie Brown in Indiana House of Representatives District 3. Ms. Hatcher joined us here in the studio this morning to talk about her candidacy and about the issues ahead. Reagan Hatcher, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we know that you are the daughter of legendary Gary Mayor Richard Hatcher. The first question I think I'd have to ask is what experiences or I would say, hate to say advantage, but perhaps it might be that you might have because that you've grown up with Richard Hatcher through his experience and yours as well, too, as being his daughter, and that you've been able to be able to say that you can put to this particular office.
Well, it's been very interesting, of course, growing up in my household. You have to think about all the things that Dad has done over his lifetime. And so I kind of grew up at the end of that. And so when I was small, I remember when he was the campaign manager for Jesse Jackson's presidential runs in 1984 and 1988. I remember when he was flying back and forth to South Africa, when he was working with Trans Africa to free Nelson Mandela. I mean, it's just so many things. I remember traveling with him, but I have to tell you, none of those things made me want to be in politics. And it wasn't until I got a bit older and saw what was happening in the community that I decided that I really wanted to make a difference. And that's when I got involved.
Well, let me ask you this. Since you've been involved in running for politics on the local level, this certainly is staying local as well, too. What do you see out of this particular race and in turn an opportunity to, if you're elected, to be able to succeed Charlie Brown?
Yeah, this race is very interesting because Charlie Brown, of course, has been a longtime state representative in Indianapolis representing the 3rd District. And I grew up knowing Charlie Brown and the things that he stood for, health care, things that I've seen him create the North Shore Health Centers here in Northwest Indiana for the benefit of poor people. It's been so many great things that he has done, but I think that we're at a point now where we have some new things coming to the forefront. Being on the city council, I've been able to see just how those decisions made in Indianapolis has directly affected Gary and the Gary economy. So I'm looking to help
taking up the issues here in the region. We've gotten, we'll go into more detail about some of these, but in particular, what have you seen in the way of changes in the in Indiana's House District number 3, especially from, we'll say, the last election?
Yes, absolutely. So in Hobart and Lake Station, after speaking with the mayors there, they're having some significant water issues in those two areas that they need legislative assistance with. So I've had an opportunity to speak with them about that. And, of course, Gary always needs economic assistance, and we want to help through education and bringing more businesses to the Gary area.
Okay. Let's take up the education topic first here. What in particular are you interested into being able to hope do in Indianapolis if you're elected?
Right. I think one of the biggest things that Gary has suffered from is the advantages the charter schools have over the public school system through financing, through the qualifications of their teachers and testing. And so I like to see those, I'd like to see some equality there to make sure that the charter schools are held to the same standards. When I was the attorney for the Gary Community School Corporation, one of the things that were passed down state was that if the Gary Community Schools or if a public school corporation wasn't using a building, then the charter schools can purchase that building for $1, even after all of the funding and financing that the public schools have put into it. So I just like to see some fairness across the rules for both.
But let me ask you on that particular point here, now that we know now that the Internal Revenue Service has kind of freed up the Gary Community School Corporation to be able to deal with the abandoned buildings, the buildings that are closed, and the emergency manager has taken that task up here. Do you think that there's anything that you'd see from Indianapolis that might assist the school district in being able to
to more fairly, certainly use the buildings that are out there. And you've, it's still along the same lines you mentioned about turning them into charter schools or into other school buildings.
Well, most of the school buildings that are owned by the Gary Community School Corporation are in poor condition at this point. I don't know if there's a charter school or even if the Gary Public Schools would like to reuse those buildings. But I know what we need to do, just driving through my community every day, I love to see those torn down. And at this point, we just don't have the funding to do that. So I hope to bring some funding from downstate. It's turned into a safety hazard in certain areas of the city. So we'd like to see the ones that cannot be used torn down.
Okay. Now, talking about economic development, that's a major point, of course, in your district, dealing with this in the city of Gary and the communities around Gary, for that matter. What might you like to see happen if from Indianapolis can something be more done to improve economic development here in the region?
Well, I think that as we just talked about, education is a big deal. And when these large companies are looking to relocate in a certain area, that's one of the things that they look at. They look at the crime statistics and they look at the quality of the educational system. And so I think that our first big goal or my first big goal when I would if I'm lucky enough to be elected is to be able to start to help our educational system get to the point where these companies are willing to come in and put their children in our school district.
Okay. On the subject of the infrastructure, you kind of talked here at first about the water problems that some communities have in the district. In general, do you think that the roads and bridges at least are on the way to being worked on properly with the efforts that state lawmakers have already done? Or if you're elected, would you like to see more done?
Well, absolutely. We have some of those areas in Gary. We have roads that, state roads that certainly need to be repaired. We have state bridges that certainly need to be repaired. Some areas in the city where the bridges have are literally crumbling. So, of course, we like to see more infrastructure help from the city, from the state. Now, here in the city, we did pass the wheel tax on the city council that gives us a bit more money to leverage loans against to repair roads on city streets. And that has been a bonus, a boost for our community. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was legislated downstate.
We're talking with Reagan Hatcher, who is one of the two candidates for Indiana State Representative in District 3, the seat that is being set aside by the retiring Indiana State lawmaker, Charlie Brown. One of the issues, of course, comes up besides education funding is dealing just in general with tax revenue as comes from the Indianapolis. What would you like to see done if you're elected to go to Indianapolis as a state lawmaker to make things more equitable here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, well, one of the biggest issues that we've had here in Northwest Indiana is our tax caps. And, of course, that's a legislative issue that started, I guess it's been almost 15 years now down in Indianapolis. It's really hindered our community. It took our budget, almost sliced it in half here in the city of Gary. So I'd like to see what can be done about that. The legislative services that can do those kind of analysis and studies, I like to talk to them about what we could do to help give us back the tax revenue, at least in part of what we used to receive. Okay. Also, the U.S. Steel, that's always been a big issue, how their amount of taxes that they pay has been significantly decreased over the years. We'd like to take a look at that as well.
Yeah. One of the other major issues that has come up, unfortunately, has been dealing with Northwest Indiana's opioid and narcotic drug problem. What would you like to see done if you could do such in Indianapolis?
Well, just in this last legislative session, the legislature passed a law that said that if you're a drug dealer and you sell narcotics to a person and they die from the use, the dealer gets 40 years, with the average being 30 in prison. I think that is absolutely the wrong approach to take. We spend so much money on incarceration and so much money on the criminal court system and keeping people in jail that I think we should kind of flip that and begin to spend that money on rehabilitation programs, inpatient, not outpatient. Outpatient is too easy to not complete. And so I like to see more inpatient programs instead of putting the money on the criminal justice side.
Mm-hmm. One of the other issues, and even though it's more of an East Chicago issue, or at least the attention has been on East Chicago, but I'm sure that in the rest of the district is the problem of dealing with contamination. We've kind of referred to some of this in what you'd like to do for economic development issues, but how about the issues of trying to deal with properties that have been contaminated by past industrial uses, and what would you like to see be able to do in Indianapolis if you're elected as a state representative?
Absolutely. Any of those companies that contaminate the ground after they have closed, they must be responsible for cleanup of that site. I think that is just what happened here. A company closed down, they tore down the building, and then they built these low-income homes on top of it without cleaning the site first. So I think there has to be some legislation passed that either requires that those kind of companies carry insurance that will ensure that those locations are cleaned, or that those companies be required to set aside so much money to clean those areas after they leave.
Well, finally, Reagan, any closing thoughts as we come up to the primary election now?
Well, sure. I have sat on the city council for approximately 6 years, one as the initial four-year term, and now I'm in my third year of my second term. And I have not only created legislation, but enacted it, voted for it, reviewed it, and passed it. I've also been part of the budget committee where we actually helped to prepare and pass the budget for the cities. In my previous positions as the attorney for the Gary Community School Corporation and the attorney for the Calumet Township Trustee's Office, I created policy for them. And I think that everything that I've done to this point, all the preparation, my work, attorney, my legal work with government, and my education in finance and business administration has prepared me for this position. So I just ask the people who are listening to please go out and vote on May 8th, and I ask for everyone's support.
You'll hear more from Reagan Hatcher and Jessica Renslow on Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock when they meet in Gary for a League of Women Voters-sponsored candidates forum. That'll be at the Temple Israel at 601 Montgomery Street in Gary's Miller neighborhood. And we'll air the event live from the debate site here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, we have another court case involving alleged public corruption here in Northwest Indiana to talk about. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke on Friday with U.S. Attorney Thomas Kirsch at his office in Hammond. And she has more in this conversation.
Mr. Merchak lied to FBI agents who sought truthful information from him in connection with what was then an ongoing public corruption investigation of which he was aware. Mr. Merchak did so purely to protect his self-interest and conceal his criminal conduct from the FBI. Mr. Merchak was a police officer sworn to uphold the law at the time he told the lies, making his conduct particularly egregious.
What if he would have, like, told the truth and still gotten caught? What would have happened to him then?
You mean with respect to the particular lies that he told, or are you asking for more information in context of the whole investigation?
If the FBI would have asked him questions and he would have told the truth, what would have happened to him then? I'm curious.
Well, I can't really answer that question because that's a hypothetical that I don't know what would have happened if he had told the truth, because he didn't.
What about the entire investigation, the thing that you were going to say?
Oh, are you talking about, well, there was... If you look at the release, it sets forth sort of what we were asking about at the time the FBI went to interview him. They were asking him about various subjects in connection with a scheme to pay bribes to obtain Lake County towing contracts. Mr. Merchak worked for the sheriff at the time, a man by the name of John Buncich, who was convicted at trial of accepting bribes, among other things. And the FBI was interviewing him on various subjects, including whether Merchak had told individuals to whom he was seeking financial contributions to his campaign how to avoid Indiana campaign finance laws by structuring campaign finance, by structuring campaign donations.
Okay, yeah, and that's the...
And we had evidence that he had, in fact, told individuals how to structure campaign contributions, and that those individuals who were at the time working in connection with the government, did in fact structure campaign contributions to Mr. Merchick, of which Mr. Merchick was aware. Then when Mr. Merchick was asked specifically about that by the FBI, Mr. Merchick lied to the FBI agents and stated he didn't, in summary, stated that he was not involved in that and didn't know anything about it, when in fact we had evidence to show that he did.
So basically he told the FBI that he didn't tell people how to structure campaign contributions, but really he did?
Correct.
Okay. So how did you guys find out about it? And how did you get the evidence? Did you tape him or something?
Yes, there were recorded conversations.
Oh, okay. And that's the evidence then?
Well, there's two pieces of evidence. There were recorded conversations with Mr. Merchick, and then, of course, the evidence of what he told the FBI during the FBI interview in November of 2016.
Oh, the lie that he told. Is there evidence that he... Do you guys have him on tape actually telling, like, an informant or something that how to dodge the law?
Yes.
What else can you tell me about this?
That's pretty much it. Mr. Merchick, I can tell you that Mr. Merchick entered a plea agreement and pled guilty to the charge that we filed today. A plea hearing has not yet been set, but we expect that will be set in the near future. Unless, Ryan, do you have any information on that? There was an initial appearance this morning at 9:45. I'm not sure if there were any hearings that were set at that initial appearance, but usually they are not.
I do not. I am looking right now.
So is he in custody? Is he in jail?
No. No.
How did he get out of jail? Or was he ever in jail?
No, he was never in jail. He reported this morning and was released on a recognizance bond.
Now, what does that mean, at recognizance?
That means that he agrees to pay a certain amount in the event that he does not show up for a court hearing or violates conditions of his bond or that sort of thing.
Okay. Now, what if he flees?
But he's not, the conditions for us to detain somebody are a danger, if they're a danger to themselves or the community, or whether or not they're a flight risk. And Mr. Merchick is none of those things, so he is on bond. And he also resigned on Wednesday as a member of the Lake County Sheriff's Department, so he's no longer a police officer.
Very interesting. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, I have nothing else to add.
Unless you guys have that date for that hearing.
I just checked. The plea hearing has not been set yet.
Okay. Hey, what court would that be in when they go
Ryan,
to...
Who's the district judge that was assigned, does it say?
James T. Moody.
Okay.
So the plea hearing will be in front of Judge Moody.
Yes, that's the district judge. The magistrate judge is Johnny Martin.
Okay, so it would be in front of James T. Moody?
Yes.
Yep, the plea hearing will be in front of Judge Moody.
Okay, and in what, U.S. District Court?
Yes, U.S. District Court in Hammond.
This conversation with Sharon Jackson, Lakeshore Public Radio, talking with... Thomas Kirsch, who is the U.S. attorney in Hammond, as well as his assistant, Ryan Holmes. They heard in the conversation there about the indictment filed in the federal court against Dan Merchick. The Indiana Department of Workforce Development estimates that there will be more than 1 million jobs to fill in the Hoosier State by 2024, and most of them won't require a college degree. In fact, many employers will be looking for highly skilled workers that have specialized certificates. The state is spending a lot of time and money these days to try to address these workforce needs. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us, many question whether the measures are truly tackling the problem.
Carl Boss steps onto the large work floor at Garrity Tool Company in Indianapolis. It's loud, but not too loud to carry on a conversation. There are bright lights illuminating each workspace where employees use a combination of their hands and machines to make a variety of metal parts. This, Boss says, is a modern shop.
And more manufacturing facilities you go in today are like this. So I think this is very representative of the industry.
Workers here make components for biomedical, aerospace, and defense contracts. They're in high demand, so they stay busy. But Boss says he often has a hard time filling open positions, despite getting dozens of applicants.
We do look for people who can differentiate themselves. And that means come through some kind of, whether it's an Ivy Tech or a Vincennes, some program where they have a baseline of knowledge in manufacturing.
An increasing number of Indiana companies are looking for workers like that, and the state is trying to help fulfill the need. Governor Eric Holcomb made workforce development one of his top priorities when he came into office, and he signed a couple of bills this year to address the challenges. One of them expands the eligibility for workforce-ready grants, which provide free training in high-demand industries. Ivy Tech Community College is a major partner in the initiative. Vice President of Workforce Alignment Operations Janet Rummel says while about 16,000 students expressed interest in the grants, only a small number qualified.
In part, it was because sometimes people had been in a program, in an academic program in the past, and perhaps they didn't do well academically, and so they were really deemed ineligible.
Legislators changed some of the eligibility rules to eliminate several of those barriers. But the partnership with Ivy Tech is one of several state initiatives to address the skilled worker shortage. And some worry Indiana's strategy isn't streamlined enough to make an immediate impact. Andrew Berger is the Senior Vice President for Governmental Affairs at the Indiana Manufacturers Association. He says the changes made during this year's legislative session were small.
There was no real overarching reform, and we were disappointed in that because we thought we were going to do this. We've been asking for a real wholesale reform of our workforce development system for a couple of years now.
The IMA came out against another workforce development bill this year that did away with the State Workforce Innovation Council and replaced it with an appointed governor's workforce cabinet. In a letter requesting a federal waiver to make the change, Holcomb says it will allow for a more nimble cabinet as well as more direct employer engagement and urgency. But Berger says the last thing the state needs is more bureaucracy.
Governor Holcomb, I forget where he said this, maybe it was in the State of the State address, said that this was the defining issue of the decade. We're hoping it's not the decade we're currently in, which has only got a year and a half left, because it's beginning to feel like we may be past the ball.
Boss agrees that some of the state's efforts could be better coordinated, but says some of that responsibility falls to employers themselves.
I don't like it when companies will go out and complain about what the schools are or are not doing as far as preparing workforce for us, because it's incumbent upon us to be a part of the solution.
The need to skill workers up will only get more urgent over the next few years as more baby boomers retire. And as Boss looks out at the people working at Garrity Tool, that's something that weighs heavily on his mind. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Governor Holcomb's announced his appointments to the governor's workforce cabinet, but the first meeting date hasn't yet been determined. Time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tricia Hernandez, Director of Marketing and Development for South Shore Arts. Welcome, Trish.
Thank you, John.
So every year at this time of year, we start to gear up for the annual Beaux-Arts Ball.
We do.
And this year, it's the 25th annual Beaux-Arts Ball.
Yes. It's a milestone.
It's a big milestone. It is indeed. So every year we have a fun theme, and we try to make a lot out of it. We do everything in our power to make it. So what's in store this year?
So mainly this year we're talking about 25 and celebrating the fact that for 25 years we've been in the community raising money for education programs, art education programs, bringing them to the community, bringing the community to us. And so it's pretty cool to have something like a fundraiser like this that has gone on for 25 years and has escalated to a point where we reach like 30,000 kids every year with the money that we get from this. This helps support everything in our ed department. So it's June 1st.
Friday, June 1st.
We're excited about the Nicole Jamrose Band, too.
Yeah.
She's
A live entertainment.
Live entertainment.
And somebody really beloved in the community, too.
Absolutely. And she does a lot of good. She'll do a lot of good dance covers and just some of your favorite music. So that'll be a lot of fun.
So plan to stay to the bitter end.
Plan to stay to the bitter end.
Which is midnight, by the way.
Right,
then
right.
Then we all turn back into mice or whatever.
Right. You kick everybody off the dance floor. And most people do. A lot of people stay till midnight.
They do.
It's a lot of fun. So we'll have a live and silent auction. Your ticket includes your dinner, your cocktails, and just a lot of fun. Great, great auction stuff.
We don't know what all of it is this year, certainly, by any means. But some of the things we've had in the past are a week in Jamaica for 12 people. That was a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
The mystery dinner.
The mystery dinner, exactly.
It's always a mystery where it's going to be, where it's going to take place, and when, and who's going to cook it.
But it's still fun because somehow it all comes together.
But the mystery dinners, and it's so fun, and this people pay $5,000 for an unknown.
Exactly.
Yeah, they just trust us.
Yeah. It's a good thing after all these years. This is your 25th ball.
Oh, God,
my 14th.
Remind me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
I always thought maybe by the 25th we could do the Gone with the Wind ball, and that would be, you know, my swan song. But it doesn't look like that.
It doesn't look like that's going
to
happen.
I'm not quite close enough to Medicare yet to pull that off.
So June 1st, and all of our auction items will be up, and you can bid on them even if you aren't coming at artsball.gesture.com. So the ball has gone mobile, and so
it's gone worldwide.
And worldwide.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. And if you want to donate, you can just give me a call at 836-1839. I am at extension 107.
And it is a good opportunity for businesses to promote themselves. And now that we're worldwide through this electronic auctioning service, you really do get incredible exposure.
You do. You do. Great. So everybody gets a lot of recognition, and certainly we appreciate anything you can donate to
us. So if somebody wants to give us a car.
A car would be nice.
A fancy car.
Yeah. Just throwing it out there.
Well, why not?
That would be.
We would give you spectacular
Somebody
media.
Gave us a piano one year, remember? That was cool. Wasn't it an electric piano or an organ? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was from their home. I think that
could
was,
have been.
Wasn't it a private?
Could have been. Yeah.
Yeah, but we do get a lot of art, obviously, because we're an arts organization.
Yes.
So the art alone is pretty fun.
Yeah.
The David hugs, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I wonder what David will do for 25. We'll have to I'll have to discuss that with him. Well, anyway, so the ball's coming up. It's always
June
a big,
1st.
Big event attended by 400-plus people. It's black tie.
It is.
And although sometimes people dress in the theme. Mm-hmm. Our theme this year, we should say, Judith Mayer has created a kind of a pop art pinball machine look to the 25. And I like your slogan about keep the
ball is rolling.
The ball is rolling. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's very cute. Okay, Trish. Well, good luck with the event, and I'm good luck to both of us.
Yeah, I was going
to all of
say
us.
We're in this together.
Yeah, no. Yeah, good luck for you. And thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
It's John Kane talking with Tricia Hernandez of South Shore Arts. And you can hear this conversation again and other conversations in the Eye on the Arts program on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.